Hello. Happy holidays. Happy Honda days.
Toyota-thon.
Toyota-thon. This is the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Janelle.
I'm Vicky.
We actually did the whole thing this time.
We did it on the last one.
I know, but we forgot.
Yes.
A couple times.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. But welcome. Happy holidays.
Happy Merry holidays.
Merry Christmas Eve.
Merry Christmas. Merry Chrysler.
What's the other? Mazda-thon.
Yeah.
Did someone surprise you with an expensive vehicle for Christmas?
I hope not. If I'm getting this out on time,
this is unhinged.
It should be Christmas Eve.
Yes.
We'll see. I mean, you know how I do. Well, I just go with the flow.
It's fine.
But happy holidays. I don't know. Happy whatever you celebrate.
Yeah.
Christmas Hanukkah.
Krampusnacht. Celebrate.
Yep.
And Da Befone, or whatever the hell it is in Italian, where the witch comes on January 5th to leave you presents.
Yeah. This is not like a Christmas episode.
No, it's not.
But we just wanted to acknowledge what is happening in the current time.
Yes. Yeah. We didn't like plan any holiday things this year because...
Listen, the end of this year has been a clusterfuck for a lot of reasons.
I wouldn't say clusterfuck is necessarily more like we're just living our lives this time.
Yeah.
Unplanned, unhinged life living.
Yeah. But now we're going to talk about murder.
Murder. Well, mine's not that murdery, but...
Mine's pretty murdery.
Overall, murder.
I have to look at my notes, but...
Okay.
It's pretty murdery.
Like I said, unhinged. The theme for 2023 is going to be unhinged.
Yes. Yeah, true. I guess... Oh, also, if this is your first time listening, a special hello to you. We're going to head over to the newsroom. Unfit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
I always get so apprehensive if this is the first time someone's listening. We're so sorry, you know, like,
uh-oh.
Wrong episode to enter on.
So our news this week comes from Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, where the wind goes sweep across the plains. Now, did you ever watch that musical?
Oh, no, I just let you go.
Okay.
You looked like you were happy in your moment over there.
I'm having a moment. Definitely having a moment.
So in Tulsa, police responded to a Brothers Hooligan, which I think is a restaurant.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yes. There was an alarm that was tripped at the restaurant. When they got there, they found Jeremy Dodd near a shed on his bicycle. Mm-hmm. He tried to run away, but they caught him because they were in cars.
Enter the cops theme song.
Yeah. So they say, this is from Fox 23 News. Officers say Dodd admitted to being in a room surrounded by hot sauce and had to kick his way out.
I'm sorry, what, sir?
And the way it's phrased, I'm like, did he accidentally end up in this room?
It's probably like he entered in through like the air conditioning shaft and then dropped down into the hot sauce vault
and was like, oh no, hot sauce. It does say that bolt cutters, a broken log, and a box of hot sauce was found outside of the shed. So he decided to steal some hot sauce while he was in there.
You know, it is liquid gold.
Yeah. I mean... Anyway, so he was arrested, but he is a tribal member, so they have to hand the case over to the federal government, I think, or federal agents. I'm not sure. Chain of custody, I think so.
Was it off tribal land?
I think so.
Yeah, we went over that in one of our episodes. Check back then.
Yeah. And he's awaiting trial, but I guess just while he was in there, he was like, let me take some hot sauce.
Yeah. Skodin, as the kids say.
We're going to move on to Netflix and Kill. This week, we're talking about Killer Sally.
Oh, yes. I did watch this.
Interesting.
What haven't I watched?
I know. Right? I found myself a lot more time on my hands to, like, catch up on some of the stuff. Also started watching Westworld. Interesting.
The very first season? Like, all the way at the beginning? Or, like...
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I finished the first season. I'm on the second
crazy.
Season.
It gets crazy.
Anyway, Killer Sally is about Sally McNeil, who is a bodybuilding person. I don't know what you call him. Bodybuilder.
Yeah, bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm. Former Marine. Mm-hmm. She meets John McNeil while they are in the Marines. He is also a bodybuilder who's like trying to make it big, you know, kind of ends up in the steroid universe.
As you do.
As you do. Incredibly abusive to her. And essentially, it gets to a point where they are in an argument and this fight, and she shoots him twice with a shotgun. Sawed-off shotgun? Regular shotgun.
I don't remember that part.
Shotgun.
A shotgun, yes.
And kills him. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this documentary is interesting for a number of reasons. It's very short. It's only like two episodes, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there is this question of, or I should say prosecutors had this question of, whether or not Sally McNeil counts as a battered woman, whether this was in self-defense.
Because she was a bodybuilder.
Yeah, they very much were like, I mean, look at how butch she is. Like, she's not a battered woman. She's like this macho, like, you know. There were allegations of Sally McNeil also kind of fighting back with John, and like it being a two-way sort of abusive relationship. Just sounded, I mean, like realistically toxic all over the fucking place.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts from you?
And that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. The weird wrestling part of the bodybuilding world is like, bull.
You mean the kink. Mm-hmm. The wrestling kink.
I mean, I don't want to yuck anyone's yum, but like,
it's, I mean, you know, it has shades of BDSM a little bit, but not as dramatic, I guess, would say, or drastic of kink play as BDSM. But yeah, I mean, like, that's it. Hey, if you want to get like choked out by a lady, go for it.
It was interesting when
it's
she
all
was
all about consent, baby.
So they interview Sally McNeil while she's in prison. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting when she was talking about getting arrested, and like the people who came to her defense was not the bodybuilding community. It was like this wrestling community.
Yeah.
That sort of sent her money for her defense attorneys and stuff. Yeah. Like, which says a lot, I think.
Well, I mean, the bodybuilding community isn't really a community.
No.
It's like every person for themselves. I've followed like health coaches / bodybuilders on Instagram before. And then when I like realized how much they like despise each other and like compete, not just on the stage, but like in life, I was like, ew, this is gross. I thought this is like a strength building community. No, everybody just hates each other.
Yeah. I think it's a good watch. It is. It takes a look at a lot of things, you know.
Her kids' interviews were fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they were there for all of this.
Oh, yes.
And
like in the interview room right after she got arrested and they were waiting and she's trying to explain to them, because they were like, well, one of them was a teenager and one was like a preteen.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of sort of knew what was going on, but not to the extent. Like, they thought that they would be able to see their mother right away. Like, she just had talked to the cops and be okay. But, like, they had to go into foster care until her family could come and get them. And it's just like, oh, my God, her poor son starts crying. Like, I'm going to cry right now just thinking about it. Like, it was gut-wrenching to see that part.
Yeah. So be prepared.
Yeah, it does get a little
it gets heavy.
It's like, oh, a little weird and interesting in the middle. And then you're like, oh, my God, these poor children.
But definitely an interesting watch. Mm-hmm. Looks at what is a battered woman.
Yeah.
Sort of this bodybuilding community and like women within the bodybuilding community specifically.
And there's some people who they interviewed who believed that she maliciously killed him because he was going to, quote unquote, leave her.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Definitely just a lot of angles to this this case. And that is Killer Sally on Netflix. This isn't an ad. I know. Not an ad, but check it out.
I mean, it's we do little ads, basically.
Little. They just don't pay us for them. So Janelle, wait. Yeah. This episode may not be appropriate for all listeners. We're talking about some raunchy stuff today.
I mean, I am definitely. I was like, mine's a little lighter. I went light for the Christmas season. I mean, not really light, but.
No. I'm bringing it down like always. But what are we talking about today, Janelle?
Okay. So I wanted to cover this particular person and their case, but I wasn't sure, like, oh, what do I do for a topic? So I decided, let's go broad. And we're going to cover cases of crimes against female-identifying peoples.
Okay. Broad I like. Broad I can do whatever with.
So this particular lady is going to take us on a really interesting ride.
Okay.
We will be discussing the life and asylum imprisonment of Edith Biddy Lancaster.
Okay, this already gives me like old-timey vibes. Anytime the word asylum is used instead of like institution,
is
it's like
Biddy. So Biddy. Yes.
Yeah. I'm very like much old-timey. So. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm ready.
So Edith was born on July 28th, 1871. She's the fifth child of a family of eight, and she was born in Essex, England.
Okay.
She had three brothers and four sisters. Her father was an architect, and she was of upper class, so well off, well to do. Mm-hmm. In a lot of my reading, they did not really discuss any of the other sisters in this entire story. So
she had how many?
She had three sisters.
Okay. So she was one of four.
Of four girls.
Four girls.
There
okay.
Three boys.
Oh, my God. I was like, yeah, that sounds like a kind of small family for...
Yeah, so a lot of children. But we'll hear a little bit about the brothers.
Okay.
But the sisters pretty much didn't exist after this.
Oh, boy.
She attended school all the way through, like, went into high school, and mm-hmm. then went on to attend a college for women called Maria Gray Training College, which is a teacher's college.
Okay.
And it was actually the first women's teacher college... in England.
I was going to say, that's pretty unusual to go to college at that time for a woman.
Yeah. So England was a little bit more responsive for colleges, but you had to be in very specific areas. So a secretary mm-hmm. or a teacher.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's all women can do.
Yeah, that's all you could do. There were a couple that let you go to school for art, but you couldn't graduate.
Like you that's
could take,
bullshit.
Right, you could take the classes.
You just
but
like
you couldn't
take classes
graduate.
As a hobby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Fun times. So, her father and brothers, they ruled over the household and they led this very traditional patriarchal like life. But Edith was not interested in any of this. She was not interested in her class. She was not interested in like being someone's fucking wife.
Fair.
So, she spent 1 year teaching after she graduated and then went on to become a secretary.
Okay.
And she was kind of really into going to the library and reading pamphlets. And so she came across some information that was interesting to her. And in 1895, she became a member of the Socialist Democratic Federation.
Okay.
So.
That's not where I saw this going.
She is a communist.
Okay.
An English communist, basically. Now, the SDF was Britain's first organized socialist political party, and it was created by H.M. Hindman in 1881. And she was a member of the Battersea branch of the SDF, and she was very involved. She went to meetings a lot. She did a lot of, like, charity work, picketing line stuff, like, mm-hmm. very involved in workers' rights, that sort of thing, and, like, really shunned her upbringing in her family.
Okay.
She worked for her, like, for a living and lived in a, like, you know, women's apartment complex, whatever they were
sure.
called back then.
Yeah.
And so it was just, like, having her own life, working for the SDF and her, as a secretary. Now, at this time, her three brothers, Henry, Frederick, and George, were all becoming really well off to do in their fields of work.
Mm-hmm.
Henry was an architect, and her two mm-hmm. younger brothers were both engineers, and they were actually really well known. They were pioneering aerodynamics and the British auto industry.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, like, they were really intensive engineers working on lots of mechanical things for different fields, and
okay.
they're, like, credited with creating the British automotive industry.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they're kind of a big deal.
Damn.
Unfortunately.
Who knew?
So they had a lot of power, too.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Edith was in the black sheep. Like, there was no doubt about it. And she really was opposed to the capitalist kind of venture side of her family and her brother's businesses. She was all for, like, science and, you know,
yeah.
engineering and all that. But she didn't like how her family was really in it for the money and the notoriety. So she was kind of not too proud of her siblings, I would say.
Yeah.
While she was part of the SDF, she met an Irish factory worker named Seamus Sullivan.
Wow. Very Irish name.
Yes. And they began to see each other. The pair decided that they wanted to live together, but not to be married.
Oh, controversial.
And this is where it's going to take a turn.
Oh, okay. Okay.
At this time, that practice was called housekeeping. So you'd be the housekeeper. Wink, wink. okay. It's a polite English way of saying you're living out of wedlock. So,
oh, my God.
The two had made plans to move in together in October of 1895. So Edith was kind of preparing to leave the flat that she shared at this woman's place, and she was going to go live with Sullivan in his home. So she was just like waiting out her, you know, lease, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, Edith's father and brothers found out that she was going to go live with a man and not be married.
Shame on you.
And they decided that they were going to put a stop to it.
Okay.
No well-off English upper-class girl should be living in sin with an Irish factory worker was basically their argument, especially because he was fucking Irish and all of the English hate the Irish. Mm. So
I just see the path this is going down and I'm like, why?
So to achieve this stopping, her father decided to take a really dark turn to keep her away from Sullivan. He called a doctor by the name of George Fielding Blandford. Blandford was a lead doctor at the Priory Hospital, which was a lunatic asylum.
Of course it was.
So, yeah, the answer to your unruly daughter is to have her committed.
Hysteria.
Nah, not quite.
Oh, God.
Something even fucking more outrageous.
Oh, God.
So Edith was not living at home, and so they had to kind of do this in a covert way. Mm-hmm. And because she wasn't living at home, like, the idea of her being controlled is, like, so fucking insane, right? Like, she's not even living with you. She's basically disassociated from you and the entire family. Mm-hmm. And yet you're still trying to control her in the narrative and, like,
yeah, that's fucked up.
Yeah, it's just fucked up. It's pure bullshit.
Yeah.
So the father decided to bring all of her brothers, the doctor and him, to her flat to try and reason with her first, and then if she still wanted to pursue this, they were going to have her committed. So Edith stated that she would not go with them willingly.
Of course. I mean, good for her.
They, like, busted into the apartment, and the landlady even came downstairs and was like, what the fuck? And, like, cornered Edith in her own apartment and were like, listen, you either get they were even willing to be like, get married to the Irishman.
Yeah.
Which is, like, to me, a scandal.
Yeah.
And she said that, like, this is not happening. She declared that she would never marry as it was immoral and that she had the right to live with and to love whomever she desired. And I was like, yes, girl.
Yes, 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 yes. I'm here for it.
Living in sin and getting it in is what I like to say.
I like that.
So the doctor, Blandford, declared her mad at the scene. He's like, she's mad.
Oh, my God.
And stated that she was committing suicide, social suicide.
Okay.
So they were going to restrain her and forcibly remove her and take her to the hospital.
I'm pretty sure that was a Motion City song.
Probably.
Oh, God.
But Edith fought back. She was, like, punching and kicking her brothers and her father and the doctor. It took all five men on top of her to subdue her and handcuff her.
I imagine those men were not used to having to do this kind of shit themselves, though. No. They just had, like, people that took care of it for them.
No, this is also a time when self-defense was a thing. This was, like, during suffragette movement and the socialist worker and anarchist kind of not uprisings, but social movements during this time were also huge proponents of women's self-defense and would teach, like, all kinds of different, like, karate, Krav Maga, all this stuff to women. So she was well-versed in how to punch a motherfucker in the face.
Nice. Nice.
So it took all five men to subdue her. And even the landlady tried to, like, intervene. She, like, was trying to pull. And this was, like, an older woman, okay? This woman was, like, in her 60s.
Oh, my gosh.
And she was, like, trying to pull the men off of her. And one of her brothers hit her in the face. Rude. What a gentleman.
Rude. Yeah.
So after she was subdued and the poor landlady got fucking punched in the face. They threw her in the back of a carriage and took her to Priory Hospital and admitted her as insane due to over-education.
Okay. Okay.
So that was a thing.
Come on now.
A purely made-up thing.
I mean, they could make up whatever they want. Just say it was like a reason for being admitted.
Yeah.
And they did.
They did. So this time period in history is when a woman could be admitted to an asylum for myriads of issues.
Mm-hmm.
The most popular ones were hysteria. Also, melancholy was another big one. Reading too much. Political involvement. What was it? Urge to vote was one. And masturbating were like the big ones.
Oh, yeah.
So... But the one kind of saving grace, I think, was that England's like lunacy laws were actually changing during this time period. And there was a failsafe in place to kind of help people. Of course, that failsafe more often than not was kind of thrown out. But there was one loophole that could get a person out of the insane asylum. So the 1890 Lunacy Act required an additional thing called a summary reception order, particularly in the case of private admissions, so private hospitals, which is where she was taken.
Mm-hmm.
This was also known as legal certification. The 1890 law stated, as an additional safeguard against wrongful committal, that a justice of the peace specially appointed, a county court judge, or a magistrate could issue legal certification for privately admitted patients. There was a £50 fine for any institution that was found to not have followed the correct procedures.
Okay.
So there are some ways to kind of get in front of judges and things to sort of state like, oh, this wasn't officially certified. They were – basically what they could do is they could declare you. The doctor could declare you. They would take you to the asylum. And then there was a 7-day grace period.
Yeah.
In which you can call in a magistrate or a judge or a secondary doctor to get an additional opinion or I forget what it was called in the legal instance, but to have it looked at and referred to. And then they could either recertify the insanity or state that there was no probable cause for this.
So it's like appealing your institutionalization decision to a third party, to like an arbitrator.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So the 1890 Act also applied a time limit. So when you stayed in a private asylum, you had 7 days. It wasn't exactly the case for public institutions. It was much longer, and it wasn't a defined time period. So you could be in there for 30 days to 60 days before anyone could really see you, or you could have an appeal.
Yikes.
Yeah. So this, you know, a person in a private institution could go ahead and get reevaluated and get released pretty quickly.
Yeah.
England had a huge problem with asylums, though.
I'm not surprised.
Let's not, you know, gloss over that.
Yeah.
There was a private versus state institution kind of issue.
Mm-hmm.
The state institutions, for the most part, were absolutely terrible. It was mostly poor people who got sent there for basically being fucking poor.
Right.
And they could get sent to work camps additionally. Mm-hmm. So they would be, you know, electroshock therapy treated in the morning and go work in the afternoon and then be locked up for the next 12 hours.
Yeah.
They were also super malnourished. They were not fed. Most people didn't even get to leave to do any sort of work camp stuff. So if you were poor in England and you got sent to an asylum, you could be sent there for just being poor. You could be sent there for being quote unquote feeble-minded, for being physically disabled, and then also, of course, for all of the other same issues that the private institutions had. So hysterical, melancholy, all that stuff. So when you're poor in this time, you have a higher risk of being put into an institution.
Sure.
For the private institutions, though, it was usually more often than not upper middle class, sometimes middle class people who were getting sent there. And with the private institutions in the beginning, there was no regulations on treatment, and the intake process was also an issue. So all of these laws were really about trying to put something on the private institutions so that people weren't just getting sent there, locked up, and never seen again.
Sure.
You know, kind of like how they did with JFK's sister.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
And, you know, like it's
I mean, honestly, the royal family did that with some of their family members, too. Like,
so rich people, if, you know, this is exactly what happened to Edith. If you reject your family and your upbringing, they will find a way to put you away or to get you out of the family because mm-hmm. you're a dirty little secret.
Yes. Yeah.
So this 1890 Act started to really pull in the reins and the practices. But sadly, the mental health industry would still truly not be held accountable in England until 1959 when they started to really put in a lot of harsher laws about treatment, how long you could hold a person, the proper ways a facility should be ran and handled.
Yeah.
And then in the United States, that didn't happen until like a decade later.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. So we're a little slow on the uptake.
Yeah. Now for Edith, her time at Priory was really short but horrifying.
Yeah.
She was there for 4 days and had suffered mental, physical, and sexual abuse.
Ugh.
Immediately after she was committed, her landlady had contacted Sullivan, her lover, and he contacted the SDF to obtain her release. So they worked really quickly.
Yeah.
They protested outside of the institution and sent written declarations to every fucking newspaper they possibly could.
Damn.
For days, this story was all over every single printed paper you could get your hands on. And people were actually reaching out to try to help her get out of there.
Really?
Yeah. So this was like, the reaction to the story was so shocking.
Yeah.
Like, people were like, she doesn't belong in there. Like, love is love. And I'm like, what the fuck? This is 1895.
Yeah. That is very surprising.
Yeah. So there is an article that I wanted to read that was pretty interesting. But all of these articles also got other people thinking. And so this one particular gentleman who goes by the name of Marquis of Queensbury.
Okay.
He actually commended Edith Lancaster's bravery and wrote to the Standard paper offering her a check for £100 as a wedding present if she would go through the legal marriage ceremony. He's like, I commend you, but, you know, maybe you should get married to this gentleman. And if you do so, like, they'll release you and I'll give you money. And she was like, no.
Yeah.
She declined. She's like, no.
No, yeah.
So, yeah. You know, people
oh, my God.
People doing stupid shit. Mm. So, under Section 11 of the 1890 Lunacy Act, a person could only be detained for up to 7 days before they had to kind of, you know, get reevaluated. So she was taking advantage of this. So the SDF, her lover, and her were really like trying to get another person to look at her case so she could be released. So on the fifth day of her incarceration, Edith was examined by the Commissioners of Lunacy, which is the people who oversee like the laws within the government.
Sure.
Particularly on state asylums. But with the 1890 law, they started bringing in private as well. And the commission found her to be sane.
Okay.
And she was immediately released.
Oh, good.
Now, in this newspaper article, it was called The Marriage Question, Miss Lancaster Released. So Miss Edith Lancaster was on Tuesday released in consequence of a communication from the Lunacy Commissioners from Roehampton Asylum, where she had been detained since last Friday. Ms. Lancaster states that on Friday morning, she was forcibly carried off from her lodgings in Battersea by her brothers, who took her in the brougham to the asylum, where she was well treated, dot, dot, dot.
Okay.
Says the newspaper.
Yeah.
On Monday evening, she was seen by two commissioners in Lunacy who, after conversing with her, said they could not detain her as they considered her perfectly sane, but somewhat foolish. Miss Lancaster adds that her opinions on marriage question have undergone no change through her detention in the asylum.
I love that they're just like, I mean, she's not crazy. She just might be dumb for not getting married. Yeah. Like, what the fuck? Oh, my God.
So the papers went even further, and they also, like, interviewed her father.
Oh, God. Okay.
And her father stated that he was, quote, justified as she was insane from overeducation. So he was sticking to his overeducation story.
Whatever, dude.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what they would feel like today with women?
Oh, yeah.
Like, being overeducated all over the place.
I mean, there are lots of cis white men that still feel that way. Republicans.
That's true. That's true.
There's like a whole fucking, did you know this, Vicky? There's a whole movement on TikTok to go back to housewife culture. I forget what it's called specifically. There's a dumb name for it. But I'm like, are you fucking kidding me right now?
I know.
No. Burn it to the ground.
It's also why a lot of those people aren't married.
Yep. You want me to do the dishes? How about you fucking do the dishes?
Yeah.
Who's working harder here, me or you? And those are my thoughts on marriage. Mm-hmm. So after hearing about Edith's plight, Eleanor Marx, the youngest daughter of Karl Marx.
Okay.
Offered her a secretary job in 1897.
That is not a cameo I was expecting.
So if you weren't aware, Karl Marx actually kind of was sent away. And the only place he could find shelter was in England. So Karl Marx lived most of his life in England. And all of his children are, English citizens.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
So Eleanor Marx, she followed in her father's footsteps and was really continuing to kind of be part of, workers' rights movements in England specifically.
Yeah.
So she offered Edith the position of her secretary, and they became, like, best fucking friends.
Nice!
And Edith was, now living with her lover, Seamus Sullivan, and they were pregnant with her – she was pregnant with her first child in 1897. And so when she was ready to give birth, she actually stayed in Eleanor Marx's home because the newspapers went fucking crazy when they found out that she was – married out of wedlock with a child.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Oh, God.
They touted in the newspaper, the articles, like, were saying things like, love child with Irishmen. Like, like stupid shit like that. Like, yeah, oh, the marriage question comes back in after love child with Irishmen.
Oh, good Lord. Why?
Yeah.
It's.
So after that, the family was kind of out of the spotlight for a while until the early years of World War I. Edith developed a growing interest in pacifist principles of Quakerism,
mm-hmm.
and the entire family was extremely anti-war. And so during World War I, her son, the firstborn, Waldo, was actually conscripted to go into the war, and he was a conscientious objector.
Okay.
And they jailed him for a year.
Damn.
He was released after that year and went on to work as a puppeteer and a theater costumer.
Nice.
So okay. Very much in a lot of the papers during this time, because there was a lot of articles about her son. So that's when they came back in the spotlight, is when her son became a conscientious objector. And they interviewed her and they're like, yes, we're vehemently anti-war. Mm-hmm. We don't believe in that. And so, like, that's when everyone started being like, ah, yes, the old unwed Lancaster and Sullivan son, like that stupid shit.
Yeah. I'm sure part of them too were, there had to have been commentary where it was like, the insaneness is inherited in the family.
Right. Now, Edith and Sullivan lived together like their whole life. They did have one other child. Her name was Elsa. Now, if you're like, Elsa Lancaster, that sounds really familiar. It's because she was a famous fucking actress.
Oh.
So, have you ever watched The Bride of Frankenstein?
Like the original?
Yes.
The
1930s Bride of Frankenstein.
I probably have at some point, but not in a long time.
The actress who played The Bride of Frankenstein is Elsa Lancaster.
Oh.
She went on to do a lot of comedy and like slapstick stuff and some additional kind of horror genre stuff, but she went on to be an extremely famous actress in the 30s and 40s.
Man, there's like connections all over the place in this story.
Yeah. There are some really beautiful interviews that she did when she was in her 50s that talk about her mother and her brother.
Yeah.
And how they were like a peaceful pacifist household and how there was constantly people coming to like talk to her mother about, her life, the SDF, working with Eleanor Marx, that sort of thing. But Edith Lancaster, like, never spoke to her brothers or her father again. She just was really dedicated to her, partner and her children.
Mm-hmm.
She did receive, oddly enough, an inheritance from her mother when her mother passed away.
Okay.
Which sounded like her mother really wanted to have a relationship with her, but probably wasn't, quote unquote, allowed to.
Yeah.
So she secretly left an inheritance to
her
daughter.
Entirely, judging from the reaction of the rest of her family, her dad and her brothers, I could see that totally.
Yeah, her father passed away first. So when her mother, she wasn't like in charge of the estate, but she got an allowance from it, an inheritance. Yeah. And so she secretly took some and left it for her daughter.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Edith and her lover Sullivan stayed together their entire lives. And he died in 1945, with Edith passing away in 1966.
Wow.
And they had a fantastic life.
Wow.
Unmarried.
Interesting.
And that is her whole story.
Interesting.
Yeah, see, I told you, not really any murder.
Don't worry, I'll put you down.
Don't worry, coming in hot with murder.
Interestingly enough, I'm also in the UK for my story.
Where all the crimes against women happen. No, welcome to the United States as well.
Yeah, right. So I wanted to look at the Babes in the Woods murders.
Ooh.
Are you familiar?
I'm a little bit familiar, but I have not read very much.
Okay. So the whole case revolves around these two young girls, Karen Hathaway and Nicola Fellows.
Apologize for saying ooh, because this is like a really tragic story.
Yes, it is very tragic.
I'm just going to roll back. I did not mean that in a positive way. I meant, ooh, this is interesting.
Yes.
So sorry.
So both Karen and Nicola were 9 years old. They were best friends who lived pretty close to each other in the north of Brighton, East Sussex. And while they lived close to each other, Karen and Nicola didn't actually go to the same school. So, like, they would come home after school and then go out and play until dinner time, you know?
Until the lights come on.
Yeah. God, that was the thing. Yeah. Yep. Street lights come on. You got to come home. Uh-huh.
Whole ass ska band about it.
Yeah.
Streetlight Manifesto. Sorry. I digress.
So they returned home on October 9th, 1986, and then went out to play with some roller skates.
Hell yeah. That's my jam.
Nicola's mom, Susan Fellows, looked out around 5 p.m. and saw the girls playing. At some point, Nicola and Karen left the yard, and they were next seen at a parade of shops in the Lewes Road area. A teenager that was like kind of an acquaintance of theirs spotted them and stopped them. And they were like, hey, like, you should probably tell your parents where you're at, because like it was not.
Because you're fucking 9 years old.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was like obviously close enough from the house that they could walk there, but like far enough that it was like, what are you doing that far from the house? And this teenager said, you know, they're probably a little worried about you. At later court proceedings, the teenage girl recalled Nicola and Karen ignoring her, and specifically Nicola saying, come on, let's go over to the park. And they were talking about Wild Park, which was kind of this place that the girls weren't really allowed to go, at least
by
themselves.
Was it too wild? Or like Oscar Wilde?
It's like WILD, but like...
Okay.
I think it's just a regular park is the impression I got. It wasn't like an animal, like a zoo or anything, or like, I don't know.
It's not like the most dangerous merry-go-round or anything.
Right, it's too wild. Next, Nicola and Karen were seen near a police box on Lewes Road around 6:30 p.m. There was another person, a man who was later identified as 20-year-old Russell Bishop, was also spotted near this police box around the same time wearing this light blue top. Which will be important.
Okay.
The girls failed to return home by their bedtime, and as you would guess, their parents started to panic. So they called 999, and the police immediately began searching for the girls. Pretty quickly, the like news of their disappearance started showing up on news outlets. So the community sort of put together their own search party as well. But it wouldn't be until the following day that searchers would find their bodies in a makeshift den in Wild Park. Now, almost immediately, police became suspicious of Russell Bishop. First, he was actively involved in the search for Nicola and Karen. Like, very actively involved.
Yeah, insert yourself into the investigation.
He even brought his terrier, Misty, that he claimed was a highly trained tracker dog.
Don't bring your pets into this. Don't crime with your pets, goddammit.
Police would later recall that Bishop was nearby when the bodies were discovered. And he even like rushed over with the constables when they were like, hey, we found something. And the constables started rushing over.
This sounds like the Delphi murders a little bit too.
A little bit, right?
Yeah.
But they later recalled like he didn't really get close enough to see anything or like really like touch the bodies or anything. Like he wasn't close enough for any of that. There was also this connection that Bishop had with Nicola's family. I think specifically her father, like he had previously worked for her father or something along those lines. Mm. But both families were kind of like do not have any contact with this guy, mainly because he had a 16-year-old girlfriend. Says even at 20 is like,
that's wrong.
Fucking weird.
That's not weird. That's fucking wrong, that bro.
Yes, it's wrong. It's wrong.
I understand the time period, right, where you have a lot of songs about, right, oh, I'm a teenage girlfriend, but that's still wrong.
Yeah, yeah. But the parents would have been like, that's a weird dude. Stay away from him.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. It was later discovered that Bishop had actually gone to Nicola's house to speak to another lodger that lived, like, in the same building. But Nicola had told him to go away and called his girlfriend a slag.
Hell yes. My most favorite fucking British, fucking like, slag. Swearish yeah. word is a slag.
Police had also discovered a blue sweatshirt with the word Pinto on it.
Like the car?
I think so. Okay. They always call it the Pinto logo, and I just assumed it was the car.
Big fan of beans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he is British. They do eat beans for breakfast.
It's true. It's true.
But the car, probably.
And it was, like, found on this direct path between Wild Park and the flat where Bishop lived, which is very strange.
Sus, as yes. kids say. Very yeah. sus.
According to the Independent, quote, it was inside out. The garment appeared to have been thrown to the ground, which suggests it had been taken off and discarded. Mm-hmm. It felt dry to the touch in contrast to the wet ground around it, which suggests that the sweatshirt had not been lying there for very long. Mm-hmm. So they pretty early on started questioning Bishop, who couldn't really give a solid alibi at the time. Mm-hmm. And he was just giving these very inconsistent statements. They also question Bishop's girlfriend at the time, Jennifer Johnson, about the sweatshirt that they had found on the path in Wild Park. Now, according to a later appeal, quote, Johnson was shown the Pinto top, and she said words to the effect of, you've brought Russell's top back. Johnson thereafter provided a witness statement stating she recognized the sweatshirt as being exactly the same as Bishop's, end quote. In the meantime, Bishop is arrested on October 31st, 1986, and then released. The following day, Johnson shows up at the police station to say that she was retracting her earlier statements and that she wouldn't attend court over the matter.
Of course.
She also, like, went to Bishop's attorneys and were like, hey, like, they're going to say I said this thing. I didn't actually say it also. So there's, like, this happening in the background. Bishop was again arrested on December 3rd. This time he was charged with the murders of Nicola and Karen. Mm-hmm. Now, Bishop's trial started in December of 1987. It was at this time, like during the trial, that some of the mishandling of the investigation came to light.
Quote unquote mishandling.
Autopsies showed that Nicola and Karen had died by strangulation and that they were sexually assaulted. However, investigators failed to take any measurements of the handprints left by the strangling or take any fingerprints, like, from the wounds. They did find fingerprints, and Bishop tried to say, like, he had run over to take their pulse, like, when they found the bodies was, like, his explanation. There was blood evidence that was left on Karen's underwear that was never tested. Of course, the blue sweatshirt was, like, a hugely important piece that prosecutors thought made this really, like, a slam dunk case.
Yeah.
However, the sweatshirt was not properly preserved, which opened the door for the defense to discredit the evidence and the reliability of it. In addition, prosecutors still, at this point, expected Jennifer Johnson to show up and get on the stand and say exactly what she had told police earlier, that she knew that the sweatshirt belonged to Bishop. But as we know, she had changed her statement. And by the time she took the stand, she was claiming she had never seen the sweatshirt. She insisted the statements that the police provided to the prosecution were fabricated by police and that her initials had been forged.
Interesting. That was a little, that goes a little hard, right?
Yeah.
This is all false.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I think there is something to be said for, like, police showing up and her having this genuine reaction of, like, oh, you found my boyfriend's sweatshirt.
Like really candid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the next day to be like,
JK, huh? Yeah.
And they communicated every day that he was in prison. They were, like, writing letters back and forth and everything.
Well, her being so young, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. There was also an issue with the timeline presented by prosecutors. So during the trial, they insisted that the girls had been killed between 5:15 p.m., which was the last time Susan Fellows had seen Nicola and Karen, and 6:30 p.m. But the defense was able to present witnesses that claimed to have seen the girls alive at 6:30 p.m. when they were spotted near the police box at the time that Russell Bishop was also there. And they just never backed down from that original timeline. Even it's still something that baffles me today. That's like, but they came up with this other witness. I mean, something to be said for reliability of witnesses and stuff. But at the same time, I don't know. I just feel like they should have adjusted for that. There's also testimony from leading pathologist Dr. Ian West, who said that based on the contents of their stomach, Nicola and Karen had actually died between 7 and 8 p.m., although he did also mention that using stomach contents was not, like, a super accurate way to determine, like, time of death. At the end of the trial, it took the jury 2 hours of deliberation before coming back and finding Russell Bishop not guilty.
Wowzers.
Oh, yeah. Just hang on, because it gets worse.
Oh, yeah. Of course
he then turned around and sold his story of being wrongfully prosecuted to News of the World for £15,000.
That sounds about right.
Now, police did keep the case open. And by that point, it was known as the Babes in the Woods murders. And they continued to investigate. So flash forward a little bit to December 1990, when Bishop abducted 7-year-old Rachel Watts.
Whoa, sounds like there's a pattern.
Almost. Rachel was out roller skating when Bishop grabbed her.
Fucking roller skates.
Maybe.
He just has a child roller skate kink.
Yeah. Although I think they left the roller skates at home when they went over to the park in the first time. Yeah, maybe. That's true. So Rachel was out roller skating when Bishop grabbed her off the street, put her in his car. He then drove to Devil's Dyke, where Rachel was attacked and raped and then left to die, essentially. The attack was almost identical to the attacks on Nicola and Karen years earlier. It was like 3 years earlier. And yet again, Bishop's girlfriend gave him an alibi.
Same girl?
I think so. I think so.
This time, I mean, when you're that young, you're basically controlled and brainwashed, you know?
Yeah, yeah. She would have still been, she would have been 19, I think, you know? This time, however, Rachel managed to survive the attack and then identify Bishop.
Good.
He was arrested, charged, and convicted in December 1990 of abduction, molestation, and attempted murder, receiving a sentence of life in prison.
Good.
Okay. Now, again, police continued to investigate the murders of Nicola and Karen, even arresting both of their fathers in the mid-2000s on allegations that they had sexually assaulted the girls. Which
both
were
the fathers?
Both of
both
the fathers.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Get fucked. Like, are you kidding me right now?
Yeah, they were completely untrue. They were, like, full-on arrested and in custody for
That's
all of
so
this.
That's so fucked up. You see so many, like, crime dramas where this happens.
It is.
And the sad truth is, like, it fucking really happens.
And it does seem like a lot of these allegations were coming from, like, Bishop's side, where it was like, well, maybe it was the dads that did it, you know?
Like West Memphis 3 kind of a situation.
Right.
Too. God fucking damn it.
Yeah. Neither of those claims held any weight. Both were eventually released and cleared. Flash forward again from the 90s to...
I'm getting vertigo with all these flash forwards.
November 2013.
Stop.
Yes. When authorities began reinvestigating the forensics in the case.
Gee, not in the early 2000s when they were going after the fathers to check the DNA? Fucking assholes.
Right? So this was, these samples were taken in 1986. You're talking a difference in the forensic field from the 80s to 2013. Like, huge.
Even in the 90s, there was big developments.
Yes.
And like no one thought,
Yeah. So in 1986, there were samples taken from the left forearm of one of the girls. Under further testing, investigators managed to find skin flakes that, after additional testing, yielded a billion to one match to Bishop.
Dear God.
The sweatshirt was also retested.
Huh. Whose was it, Vicky?
Showing a second billion to one match to Bishop's DNA.
Get out of here.
Upon further examination, there was like the sweatshirt was found to contain fibers on the clothes of Nicola and Karen that like matched fibers found on the sweatshirt and vice versa. Mm-hmm. As well as paint fragments from a car that Bishop had been repairing. He like worked with car auctioners and like repainted cars and stuff. So yeah. There was like paint flecks on the sweatshirt.
That shit does not come off.
No, it does not. So in May 2016, Bishop, who at this point was serving his life sentence for the attack on Rachel Watts at Franklin Prison, was taken to a local police station where he was again arrested for the murders of Nicola and Karen. You might be wondering about double jeopardy and like kind of how that applies here, and especially in the UK, because they just have such different laws than we do.
Yes.
And even at the time, there was like some question as to whether or not this would come into play. However, in 2005, they'd actually passed legislation that said a person accused of a crime could stand trial a second time if substantial new evidence was found.
So DNA.
DNA, I would say, counts for
pretty fucking substantial.
Yeah. So the prosecution in the second case took kind of a different stance on the timeline than they had in 1987. It was interesting because it was kind of the same but kind of different. So they brought back a lot of witnesses that had originally testified on the timeline for the defense, brought them back as prosecution witnesses to say instead that Bishop had left and then returned at 6:30 and persuaded the girls to go with him to the park. So rather than saying this hour is like it was within this hour that Nicola and Karen were killed, they said, yes, they were still alive and Bishop was seen there, but he left and came back to like take the girls into the park. Mm. And then the prosecution honestly refused to commit themselves to a solid timeline, which ultimately helped their case. From the Guardian speaking to Nigel Pilkington, the senior district crown prosecutor for CPS Southeast, quote, Pilkington added that both in 1987 and 2018, the prosecution only had to prove that Bishop murdered the girls, not when he killed them. We don't actually know when he killed them, said Mr. Pilkington. Only Russell Bishop knows that. Which, fair enough.
Yeah.
Finally, on December 10th, 2018.
Fuck off.
Yeah. After 2.5 hours of deliberation, Russell Bishop was found guilty of the murders of Nicola Fellows and Karen Hathaway. He had committed the crimes when he was 20 and was finally held accountable at age 52.
Okay.
I know. It's just the length of time that this case spans is insane to me. In their sentencing remarks, Justice Sweeney said, quote, during this trial, you again falsely pretended that you were innocent and made the allegation, which you were able in law to do, that Nicola's father, Barry Fellow, could have been the murderer instead. That will not add a day to your sentence, but it underlines that you have no remorse whatsoever for what you did. Indeed, I observe that Barry Fellow stood in the witness box and dealt with all the questions that were asked of him in cross-examination, despite the understandable distress that it caused him, whereas after your initial cross-examination by the prosecution had exposed you as a pedophile and a liar, you refused to answer any more questions and have subsequently refused to attend court at all, or even today to attend by video link. Hence, I am sentencing you in your absence. So he wasn't even there for his sentencing. Like, yeah, she very much hit the needle on the head when she was like, we called you out on being a fucking pedophile. And you were like, I'm out. Whatever. Bishop was sentenced to two life sentences with a minimum of 36 years. He is, like I said, 52. So even a minimum of 36 years puts him at 90.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Now, this is not quite the end of the reckoning in this whole case. In May 2021, Jennifer Johnson, who was Bishop's girlfriend at the time, she was the 16-year-old, But she was 50 in 2021. She was arrested and charged and convicted of perjury and perverting the course of justice.
Well, okay.
So they came back around and was like, remember that time you lied to the court multiple times?
Mm-hmm.
Like all those times? We got you.
Good.
So she was given a 6-year sentence and is currently in prison in Britain's high security prison for women. Bishop, while serving out his life terms, died from cancer on January 20th, 2022.
Well.
Yeah.
Super current.
Yeah. It just, this one, like, I think anytime I see a case that was like kind of mishandled by police or blatantly mishandled by police is like,
they try to clean it up a little bit this time.
Definitely piques my interest. I think this one was interesting in just when the prosecution came around the second time. They very much did not want to like admit fault on the police at all. They were like, they did what they felt they needed to do at the time and what was right and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, y'all, there's some other crazy stories from this case. Like one of the witnesses that was like a pathologist or a forensic guy or something. One of the cops got so upset with his testimony in the 1987 trial that when he left the courtroom, he got slammed up against a wall.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Super excessive.
Yes. Yeah. So if you need, let's bring it back around. If you need a break from your family this holiday, why don't you check out this podcast?
Hello, this is Margot P.
And this is Margot D. And we are the Margos.
We are the Margos, co-hosts of the Book versus Movie podcast. We are the podcast that talks about films that are adapted from books. We read the book, we watch the movie, and then we decide which we like better, the book or the movie.
Now I know what you guys are going to say. Duh, the book is always better than the movie. To which we always reply, Have you ever read Jaws?
We are not film experts or literary geniuses.
Nope, we're just two friends who like to chat about books and movies.
We really like to go for a deep dive into the history of the book and the background of the author and the trivia from the movie set.
And most of all, we just like to have fun, so we never take ourselves or the books or movies too seriously.
You can find us wherever you sign up for your podcast under the name Book versus Movie.
And on social media, you can find us at Book versus and Movies. You just spell it all out.
Hope you check us out soon.
Well, that has been our episode.
We did it.
Jingle bells, jingle bells.
We made a podcast.
Yeah.
Yay.
I don't think we have really anything coming up.
No.
Keep an eye out for stuff that we will have going on next year in 2023.
Ew.
I know. I've been scheduling stuff for 2023 since like November. So.
No. See, I'm like, that's a 2023 problem. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
Don't blame me. Blame the courts.
We always blame the courts here.
They do status calls 3 months out. So I'm like scheduling all this stuff 3 months out, and it's like March 2023. I'm like, fuck.
I know.
It feels
too
gross.
Far.
It feels gross. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more like this on badtastepodcast.com. We've also got merch. If you need a super last minute Christmas present, it might not get there by tomorrow, but you got them at New Year's.
Yeah, right?
You've got until New Year's, I would say.
January 5th.
Yeah.
There's a couple holidays that fall on January 5th if you're very
Chinese New Year,
Catholic and stuff.
You got time for that still.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess that's it. Do we have anything else?
No, that's a podcast. Okay. And that's it. I hope you had a great holiday.
Yeah. I hope you guys had a safe holiday.
Yeah.
Let's stay safe, stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
No COVID over the holidays, no Christmas COVID.
Yeah. So keeps on giving. Yeah, keeps on giving.
Our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, the Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2023.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
To
ho, ho, ho.
You.
Ho, ho, ho.